From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at cseashawaii.com.
So first of all, I would like to thank the Center for Southeast Asian Studies, University of Hawaii, especially Paul for organizing this, for inviting me to share my research, and also for the Women's Studies Program for co-sponsoring the event. Actually, my research is more about the contemporary film culture and sexual politics. But I have one chapter that is more historical. So it's kind of tracing back, answering the question of why we've got here and how. I'm going to start by explaining the contemporary film scene just a little bit. So after the downfall of Suharto, in 1998, we witnessed the revival of Indonesian cinema and the emergence of women filmmakers, scriptwriters, and directors. Within a relatively more democratic climate, this coincides with the emergence of women writers, activists, artists who challenge the new order gender construction and frankly examine how women experience their bodies, desires, and sexuality. So today we could say that women have more significant roles in film production, exhibition, and distribution as producers, directors, scriptwriters, and festival organizers. This is a very dynamic situation, and we can say that it's a new privilege in the history of Indonesian cinema, as records indicate that there were only four women filmmakers between 1925 and 1998. Who directed their and produced their film. So what actually happened before 1980, Amit Priyono, who was a film director, said that it's time for women to emerge as filmmakers. So there was some kind of endorsement, there was public enthusiasm about women making movies. But there was only one woman filmmaker who was active throughout the 1990s and 1980s. So through this presentation, I would like to revisit the New Order film culture to trace how gender discourse was produced by state paternalism and cultural paternalism that underpinned the male-dominated film scene. I'm going to return a little bit to the New Order gender ideology. So the familial relationship is very important to the New Order as it defines the nation and it prescribes the relationship of power from the family unit to the top level political structure. So in this case, I am indebted to the Saya Shiraishi study. She is an anthropologist writing about the relation between family and politics in Indonesia. So she said that the New Order regime is built on the hierarchical relationship between father and son, expressed in the relationship within institutions, such as between higher ranked government officers and their juniors. So a famous example of from Shiraishi's book is when Suharto calling them his ministers as children, and he was addressed as father, Bapak Suharto, or Bapak means father, but and it also means Mister, but like the Bapak Presiden, it's like the ultimate father of the nation. And of course, Suharto claimed himself as the father of national development, Bapak Pembangunan. State paternalism emphasized the hierarchy between all-knowing ruler and the immature, undeveloped nation. In this framework, the rakyat, or the people, was an entity that needs to be guided. So this is the logic that Saya Shiraishi called the father knows best logic, and it underpinned state policies from sexual regulation to film policy. So, for instance, in the sexual regulation, there was this program called Keluarga Berencana, or Family Planning Program, where medical paternalism was rampant. So women were forced to choose certain forms of contraception without being given enough information about why they had to choose the contraception. So it was based mostly on the principle of doctors know best. Now, film censorship was imposed within this logic as well. So censorship was needed to protect the society, because without censorship, the society could be easily provoked. Censorship was needed to guide them to choose which film was good and which was not. Within the state paternalistic logic, men, women, and children should function properly, and the role of the women was constructed as wives and mothers. Now, a lot of research has been done about gender in the New Order period. Well, not so much on the manhood or the construction of masculinity, but a lot of research has been written about the role of women. One of the important key terms was the ideology of egoism or motherism. This was a term coined by Madelon Jayadiningrat Nieuwenhuis, which refers to a woman's role of woman's reproductive and nurturing capacity. But she did, a woman did have social role. So publicly, she had to maintain the status of whether it was family or a group. So she was, Madelon said, the keeper of harmony and the guardian of power. And this role was institutionalized by the state within the organization, such as Dharma Wanita. So this was, it was very much a military-style organization. This consisted of wives of civil servants, basically their roles were limited as supporters of their husbands. So they supported political campaigns of their husbands, and then they taught other women in the village to make use of available resources for cooking. So, well, this is actually this is a Dharma Wanita picture, but it's not in the New Order period. This is contemporary situation, because as you can see, a lot of women here are wearing the hijab, and back then in the 1980s, we did not see Dharma Wanita women wearing the hijab due to Suharto's politics that tried to suppress sort of extreme expressions of Islam.
And the use of LPG.
Oh! Right. So basically, women were not encouraged to be politically active, and their roles were fixed as mothers and wives. Now, what about the film culture? The common assumption was that there was state control on cinema, and then it was followed by filmmakers' complicity. So a lot of writings about the New Order cinema were based on the assumption of were simplified in terms of censorship. So the difference between Indonesian cinema before and after the New Order is like this. For instance, we have freer climate. There is no censorship. Even though there is censorship, it's largely ignored. There is more freedom of expression. And then back then, there was strict control. There was complicity. Krishna Sen, in her book on the institutionalization of cinema during the New Order government, wrote that the strict film regulation prescribed a specific narrative of New Order cinema. So New Order cinema, according to her, moves from order to disorder and then returns to order. And order restoration means the restoration of norms that conform to the New Order ideology. So in other words, New Order, the creativity of the filmmakers were limited by the state ideology that manifested itself through institution and censorship. This is, of course, partly right, because censorship did exist, and self-censorship too, because there were two layers of censorship. So before, in the New Order period, before you you start shooting, you have to submit your script to the Department of Information for review, and then there was a post-production censorship. And the government also funded propaganda films. They commissioned big budget films that basically glorify the role of Suharto. And Naila will talk about Pengkhianatan G30 PKI, or the 30 September movement treason, as an example of a New Order propaganda film tomorrow at the AAS conference. So basically, this film is about the communist coup and the rise of Suharto as a national hero. And this film actually involved the best people in the film scene. It was directed by Arifin Chenur, who was like the maestro of Indonesian cinema. However, we cannot make a generalization that Indonesian filmmakers were totally compliant to the state ideology. So to discuss this further, I will briefly talk about the background of some prominent filmmakers, the maestros of Indonesian cinema. These people were regarded like pioneers or maestros, and they proclaimed themselves not only as filmmakers, but artists, seniman. So that positioning was very important at that time, and I will go to it later. First of all, I'm going to talk about the background, the theater background. So today, a lot of filmmakers come mostly from film schools, from the urban centers or abroad, or from the advertising industry. But back then, theater served as a very productive environment that shaped the works of these major directors. And the artistic climate was more, how should I say, more dynamic, because there were more collaborations or interactions or even dialogues and movements across disciplines, films, visual arts, performance, literature. Arifin Chenur and Teguh Karya were known not only as film directors but also as theater directors. And Astro Sani was an important literary figure whose works have been included in the Indonesian literary canon. And then, in terms of exposure, they had this very much global exposure. So today, in Indonesia today, films are populated with global reference. And this was due to the background, the education background. People were educated abroad, and then, of course, there's this flow of images through the media. Some contemporary filmmakers today are often accused of being too Americanized. But, of course, they have no problem with that, and then they just celebrate their cosmopolitan worldview. Now, actually, the accumulation of cultural capital in the transnational sphere is not new. The New Order filmmakers had studied abroad thanks to the flow of scholarship in the Cold War period from the United States and the USSR. Although, according to rumors, if you get a scholarship to study in the Soviet Union, you cannot get a scholarship from the US, or vice versa, which makes sense. So Shumandaya and Ami Priyono went to the USSR, and then the others, such as Mia Abbas Akub, studied at UCLA, and then Astro Sani studied at USC, and Teguh studied at the East-West Center here. Despite this global connection, the biggest obsession among these filmmakers was the search of wajah Indonesia asli, or the real face of Indonesia. So this is a term shared by critics in the 1970s to respond to the majority of Indonesian films, which, according to these critics, these films only promote luxury and they do not reflect the reality of Indonesian life. So the need for a national cinema to represent national reality was also a concern among filmmakers, as Teguh Karya stated. I'm just going to read it. "I want to see Indonesian films that do not imitate films from other countries. An Indonesian film needs to have an Indonesian narrative with Indonesian way of thinking made by Indonesians." The reason why the concept of national cinema was embraced and rigidified was more complex, actually, than merely an aspiration not to imitate films from other countries. Of course, there was a struggle against Hollywood's domination, which characterized the struggle of third cinema elsewhere in that Cold War period. But this had to be seen as inseparable from another important factor, which was the domination of producers who perceived film merely as commodities, as commercial products. So at that time, especially in the 1970s, there was a map shared by these male film artists and critics. Within this map, there was, on the one hand, the artists, the people who viewed art as viewed film as an art form, and then on the other side, there was the commercial stream, commercial producers whose main agenda was to sell films as commodities with images of luxury, romance, sex, and violence. Having said that, the discourse of national cinema among artists and critics was not an extension of the national cinema concept formulated by the government. The national cinema concept for the government was a projection of national cohesiveness and a fortress, largely within the military framework that guarantees national security. So, well, I'm going to talk a little bit about what was actually the ideal nation according to the official version. It revolves around the idea of national progress within the framework of developmentalism, which of course characterized a lot of military dictatorships in the Cold War period. And this ideal nation foregrounds the harmony of specific values, first capital-driven modernity, and of course the Suharto regime was very much supported by the U.S. And then Javanism. So there's always this rhetoric of preserving cultural tradition, but of course that the so-called culture only privileged central Java as the representation of Indonesian true culture. And also militarism, because military ensured the smooth process of the development. So here you have 1, 2, 3 postcard images. And these were very common images in New Order's visual projects. So they could be found easily in, for instance, the big budget project of Taman Mini Indonesia Indah, or that's a miniature park, beautiful Indonesia in miniature park. So that's a heritage park that was initiated by the president's wife, Mrs. Tien Soeharto, after her visit to Disneyland. So we could say like the whole archipelago was Disney-fied, or was miniaturized and was cohesive within this park. The last one here was not a glossy touristic image, but this was a famous program called Abri Masuk Desa, or the army goes to the village. And we even have this kind of show, like a documentary of the how the military assists people in the remote areas to develop their village. And there was only one television station at that time in the 80s, and we had no other choice but seeing all these Abri Masuk Desa shows. So, going back to the discourse of national cinema and the complexity within the term, what did it do to the films made by the New Order artists? So, in an interview that I did with Mira Lajmana, who was who is a famous producer, she told me about her impression about the New Order film directors. She said, "Oh, Teguh and Schumann, they made all these social issues film, and they always talk about poverty. Now, poverty, why poverty? The real face of Indonesia is apparently a bleak reality within the imagination of these film artists. Poverty, showing poverty means showing social discrepancies produced by the New Order developmental projects. So there was the kind of staple image in all of these, in many of these films made by the artists. There was this contrast between skyscrapers and slum, the image of uneven development. We could see this from Arifin Chenur's Matahari Matahari, or how do you translate it? Sun. And then in Langit Rumahku, my sky, my home by Slamet Raharjo, or Sidul Anak Betawi, Sidul the Betawi Kid by Shumanjaya. And the bleak realities of the nation are often portrayed in the tradition of modern realist theater, because, you know, with regards to their theater background, they had very strong emphasis on the strength of acting and dialogues, and very carefully staged mise-en-scene. This national reality was also influenced by the desire to distinct one's position, the director's position as an artist, from the films made or encouraged by commercial producers. Films made by these artists tend to move away from the dream of luxurious lifestyle. So the New Order film artists express view on the nation that often clash with the one asserted by the state. Although, as Krishnathan argues, the New Order cinema narratives tend to end in order restoration, the nation is not always portrayed as cohesive. But not all films made by the New Order artists are about poverty. They did have images of luxurious lifestyle, but they were often associated with feelings of emptiness. So I'm going to show you an example of this. So they had a strong critique, actually, on modernity, but they conveyed this in very subtle ways, so it really depends on whether you can get it or not. So one clip that I will show you is Apa Yang Kau Cari Palupi, or What Are You Looking For, Palupi. A summary. This is the story of Palupi. She is the wife of a playwright. She's searching for happiness, basically, but all in the wrong place. And then there's a scene showing Palupi laying on her bed or sofa, and says, "I'm bored," in Madame Bovary's sense. And she leaves her husband to become an actress and to be a mistress of a rich businessman. This, the whole searching, however, leads Palupi to nothing but emptiness. So I'm going to show, a clip where we can see the interaction between Palupi and her playwright husband in their small apartment or small house.
Kenapa sekarang jadi begini? Bagaimana semua ini terjadi? Gimana mulainya? Gimana?
Suamiku Haidar, seorang pengarang yang bekerja keras. Yang ia cari ialah harga diri, bukan pangkat. Kebebasan, bukan uang. Ia hidup di dunia hari esok. Dunianya adalah dunia seorang pencipta. Luas, tumbuh selalu. Dan duniaku, kamar inilah. Sempit, tidak berubah-ubah. Dari hari ke hari yang itu-itu juga. Jika aku ingat ini, maka rasa benciku padanya tambah besar. Apa hidup ini cuma sebegini? Aku begitu bosan. Kini umurku sudah lebih 30 tahun. Tanpa ku ketahui, pada suatu pagi aku akan terbangun sebagai seorang nenek-nenek. Aku berhak menikmati hidup ini. Sekarang.
Tidurmu seperti gadis kecil.
Aduh, rambutku. Jangan, aku lelah.
Ucapanmu selalu begitu. Karanganku sudah selesai.
Bagus.
Menurut hematku, judulnya lebih baik diganti saja. Persahabatan dengan sebatang pohon. Bagaimana kedengarannya? Nama itu lebih dapat menggambarkan macam hubungan antara kedua manusia yang terdapat dalam drama ini. Yang satu menjulang dengan segala kelengkapannya dan memberi tanpa bicara.
Asrul Husaini, the director of this film, said that, oh, this is a film about a problem faced by modern women. But to go further from that, Palupi is actually the gendered embodiment of the consequences of modernity, of the excesses created by the illusion of progress. And I mean, talking a little bit about this style of directing, the New Order filmmakers had more emphasis on the staging, and you could see how it was very detailed. The scene showed how narrow and unchanged the space is, the cramped space, the cage that Palupi wants to break through. In this film, Haidar, Palupi's husband, is the representation of the contemplating artist, poor, disturbed, marginalized by the capitalist system. He is the idealization of feeling or consciousness that people no longer have in the modern world. The illusion of modernity is feminized in the figure of bad woman, which of course echoes many films made in the early 20th century that criticized modernity and the materialistic society. So this film showed how gender roles and gender metaphors were imagined by the New Order film artists, and it is quite obvious probably now that all the artists that I discussed were male, and this results in the predominant male perspective in the film scene, even in the so-called idealist film. Paternalism in film culture, I will discuss how paternalism manifested itself in terms of positioning, how the artists position themselves in relation to the state and the society, leadership, and then the tradition of apprenticeship. First of all, positioning. There was a triangular relationship between the artist, the society, and the state. But within this relationship, the artist was not a part, or did not imagine himself as a part of the masses. He was outside. He was burdened with the commitment and responsibility to the people, because it was from the culture of these people that his work was conceived. The people was the source of inspiration, so the artist in turn had to be the educators of their society. And this logic actually underpins the support of artists, of these film artists, for censorship during at least in the early 1970s. So censorship helped, according to them, censorship could assist the society to filter good films from the trash. We know that a lot of sex and violence films were made at that time. But of course this support backfired in later years, because even their films got censored. Ansel Osani said that the artist is the hati nurani, or the conscience of the nation, which delineates his exceptional position as the voice of the nation and the mediator between the people and the government. The mediator function, according to filmmaker Shuman Jaya, obliged the artist to be able to detect what is wrong in the society. And so it is implied that the ability to detect what is wrong does not come from the masses, but from the small groups of elites who have the authoritative voice. And this echoes what Saya Shiraishi called the father knows best attitude, permeating the New Order state institution. The second point is leadership. So the film artists were regarded as leaders of their groups, taking the role of father and teacher. And this kind of tradition was in line with the theater tradition, where in the theater group, the members were the membership of the group was based on the familyism tradition, kekeluargaan, with a strong leader functioning as a bapa, or as a father, unifying the whole group. So at that time, a lot of theater actors migrated to film, and usually their success was often measured based on the success of the bapa, of the leader of the theater group, for instance, Wes Rendra, to train the members. Although their careers were not necessarily related to their former theater groups, their achievements were often perceived as the result of the father's training. Teguh Karya was described as a paternal figure who gave birth, while taking the mother's role, to strong film actors in Teater Populer. He was the one who discovered and polished actors to shine. Finally, apprenticeship. Now, the tradition of apprenticeship originated from the Japanese occupation era, where the Japanese taught the natives to make films, propaganda films, and then it continued in the 1950s and 1960s. And in the late 1960s, it was institutionalized within KFT or the Film and Television Workers League, or KFT or KFT. It was Ms. Bahyu Sabiran. He was a former filmmaker, but was later known as an archivist, film archivist. He was concerned with the high number of these sex and violence films, so he established KFT as a film, as a system that facilitated filmmakers, as aspired filmmakers, with education so that they could make good quality films, not the sex and violence films. And of course, at that time, the film school was very, the number of film schools was limited. There was only one, actually. So education was given in the form of apprenticeship with an established director. So the working culture, or the system, goes like this. So you start at the very bottom, maybe as a script boy, and then you move gradually to, let's say, assistant director, before you could finally become a director. And that the whole process could take maybe 5 to 7 years. And then when you have your first film, you have to defend it. So like a thesis, you have to defend it before a certain committee, and the committee members will test you on film theory and on your own film, the reason why you make your film this way. So the logic of the KFT's apprenticeship system is similar to censorship in a way. It is a filter against all these bad quality films. Now, the problem is, as most established directors were male and the standards of good films were largely defined by male, these standards and the long process of getting into the director's position have contributed to the factors why women were discouraged to take part in the film scene other than as actresses. So now the question, where were the women? So before 1998, there were only 4 women directors in Indonesia. Ratna Asmara made films in the 1930s, Sofia Wede and Citra Dewi maybe at the same period, 1960s, 70s, and then Ida Farida, 1970s, 80s, and 90s, actually. So all of these, the 3 women here, except for Ida Farida, they started their careers as actresses, and they were known better as actresses. The media was dominated by male critics, of course, and the media never ranked them among the pioneers of Indonesian cinema. The 4 women were often grouped together in articles that show that these are the promising women filmmakers, a positive sign for the future. So yes, there was enthusiasm, but there was also an implied view of not quite there. When their works are discussed in the media. So the best of Indonesian cinema remains the cinema of the Bapa, of the father, Shumanjaya, Nyabas Akut, and so on and so forth. So we see the difference between gender ideology in terms of gender and paternalism in film culture. Whereas the New Order government fixed women's roles as mothers and wives and discourage women's participation in politics, there was actually enthusiasm expressed around the entrance of women in the as film directors. Women, or some articles said that women should be like Kartini, or the icon of women's emancipation in the modern time, and women should bring their own perspectives in the film scene. But paternalism in film culture resulted in ambivalent views on women filmmakers. So they were supported and to some extent celebrated, but not because of the value of their work, but because they were rarities. And the praise on their courage in taking up the male role was followed by prejudice and distrust on their capacity. I would like to focus on Ida Farida, who was the only woman director active during the 1980s and 1990s. Her career illustrates a woman's place within the paternalistic culture. So she was the only woman following the apprenticeship tradition set up by KFC, and she worked with several producers. So her career track was similar to other aspiring male filmmakers of the period. The three other women had directed and produced their own films before KFC was formed. Her career track was interestingly considered as a marker. Women could finally enter the male system. She has challenged the assumption that a woman director could make a film because she is the owner of her film company. So Ida was praised because she did not produce her own film, which is kind of strange. And she built her career for 7 years working as publicist, script girl, and assistant director. Her first film was called Guruku Cantik Sekali, or My Teacher is So Beautiful, in 1970. I forgot. I'm sorry. It was successful commercially, but the KFC committee members who evaluated her film did not perceive that she was qualified enough to be a director. So here's the story. So as a KFC member, she had to pass the test, right? Pass the defense. She had to show her knowledge on film theory, and she had to defend her thesis, her film, to be a legitimate director. Unfortunately, the committee members at that time, the committee consisted of Astro Sani, Teguh Karya, Arifin Jenu. These are all male artists that I talked about, and then Jadis Badar, editor. All of these people were male. They did not pass her. So she was able to answer questions on film theory, but the committee criticized her film for lacking dialogue, because her dialogue lacked depth. So they call it dangkal or shallow, and how her film lacked creativity. So Ida was really enraged with this decision, and she expressed her dissatisfaction in the media. She said, "Oh, this decision was advantageous to me personally and to my actors." She was really outspoken. The dialogues in the film, according to Ida, were dialogues spoken by real teenagers when they are entering adolescence. So there's this degree of realism that she is trying to fit in. She assumed that the committee evaluated her film based on the art standard, whereas she emphasized more on the value of entertainment and how you could successfully communicate to your viewers, in this case, the teenagers. Teenage audience. She said, "I don't understand what standards they use for the test." She was finally legitimized as a director with her second film, which was more serious and incorporates suggestions from others, including her brother, Misbah Yusabiran, who ironically was the founder of KFC, which did not pass her. We could see here that the works of women filmmakers tended to fall in the popular frame that did not usually fit to the standard to the artistic film set up by the male artist or the male critics. This was actually similar to literature, where prominent critic in Indonesia, Jacob Sumarjo, differentiates women's writing from the high literature produced by males. He said that women's writing was mostly about romance and marriage, whereas all these high literary works produced by men were concerned with big issues such as nationalism. So women's films were not considered serious enough because they were mostly melodrama films about personal relationships. Women filmmakers actually negotiated a lot with the commercial stream. They also directed, other than melodrama, they directed genre films that were popular at that time. Both Citra Dewi and Sophia Wede actually directed and produced martial arts films, but with female heroines attacking the bad guys. So to give an illustration of what Ida Farida film looked like, I would show a clip. This is not from her best film, but it gives us an idea of her feminist sense in the film, and also how it is very much designed as a popular film. This does not have a subtitle. The men are playing games while the women are cooking, so they are in they're camping.
Makanya jadi perempuan gak usah sekolah tinggi-tinggi, percuma akhirnya kita pun juga.
No, itu kan jalan yang kita berupaya ini emansipasi, Bung.
Kau tak berupa dengan emansipasi, tapi kau juga ada lupa nanti kau sudah kawin. Perempuan harus menurut dan mengabdi pada suami. Jadi
Pak, hati-hati kau, kayaknya kau gak bakal langganin.
Mana mungkin. Kandika sudah ditakdirkan dari istriku. Makanya dari sekarang dia harus siap-siap untuk mulut dan mengabdi padaku.
Kalau begitu pendapatmu, oke, sekarang buka mulutmu. Biar aku suapin. Kau bilang bayi masih panas, suapin.
Ya, itu kan masih panas.
Tapi kenaikan bakar aja takut. Karena aku rutin dengan anak siap-siap.
Oke, so basically this is about the relationship between Tika, who is a career woman, and she is going to marry her boyfriend Pras, who is going to be a doctor. And Pras is apparently a very misogynist character. So during the camping, he says, that's why women don't have to go to college. It's a waste. They end up being in the kitchen. And then his friend said, don't forget, after a woman, a woman friend said, that's old fashioned, remember women's emancipation? And Pras said, I remember that, but don't forget, after a woman gets married, she has to obey and dedicate herself to her husband. And his friend said, Pras, be careful, I don't think your girlfriend will be submissive to you. Pras said, how come? Kartika is destined to be my wife. That's why she has to prepare herself to obey me. And Tika said, if that's what you think, open your mouth. I'll feed you. You're indeed a baby that has to be fed. Pras said, so she offered him the grilled fish, the hot grilled fish. And Pras said, that's hot. Tika said, so you're afraid of grilled fish? These dialogues were very light, but they expressed sort of resistance towards gender construction, Tika's resistance. But of course, visually, the film has a more popular look that looks very different compared to the more artsy Palupi film that we saw earlier. Another aspect of this the place of women in the system is the less articulated authorship. So women filmmakers at that time did not articulate their authorship as persistent as the male artists. So the male artists were preoccupied stating that I am a seniman, or I am an artist, to make themselves distinct from the commercial producers. Ida Farida was more low-key, and she claimed that a film is a collective work that depends on the cooperation between everyone involved in the production. So this is very different from the male artists who could formulate who articulated their aesthetic choices and making them self-distinct from the commercial stream. Ida stated that filmmakers should have an instinct for business because film was also a commodity. This does not mean, however, that women filmmakers had no agenda. As we could see in the clip, she wanted to show strong female characters. Ida mentioned that her reason to focus on women's lives was driven by the works of male filmmakers who did not portray women as a whole. So she actually criticized the lack of women's perspective in the film scene. Well, even less serious martial arts films of Sophia Wade, for instance, features a heroine who fights evil men and injustice towards women. So there was always this space of female agency in the works of these women's popular films. Finally, there is this constant suspicion on leadership. So Ida's rage after her failed defense actually reflected her public persona that resisted stereotypes of femininity at that time. And you could see her the way she presents herself here. She was known as a straightforward woman who cut her hair short, and she always wore men's clothing, and she smoked 3 to 4 packs of clove cigarettes a day. So despite the themes of her films, which are mostly about women, Ida was described as a woman that lacks femininity, with voice that pierces the room as she directs her actors. And her personal life was always involved in the media stories, including the story of an unmanageable marriage life followed by a divorce. But Ida did not seem to bother projecting the image of a complete woman who could balance her career and the cohesiveness of her family. The act of taking a more manly persona was effective, actually, to survive in the male world, where Ida had to work with film crews who, according to her, were 99% male. But her straightforwardness also triggered rumors about her being arrogant. Her colleagues said, "Actually, we want to help Ida because she is a woman. It is a rare thing that we have a woman director in the history of national cinema. But the progress of her career should not have made her arrogant." So film people described her as a filmmaker who forgot her roots because she protected her cameraman from whom she learned a lot about cinematography for impeding her creativity. So all these rumors imply that a new filmmaker, especially a woman, had to be helped. But Ida turned out to be a wayward child who could not respect her teachers. So support of women filmmakers existed almost seamlessly with suspicion. In other words, women should be directors, but there are always reasons why they could not. So a journalist, while praising Ida Farida, journalists often brought questions on why do we have so a few number of women filmmakers. The answer they propose often resort in the nature of femininity. I will just read this because this is quite hilarious. There were only few women who direct theater or film. Directing is different from writing, which was more individual and emotional. Characteristics that belong to women's nature. A director's job is related to other issues. Directing requires more than artistic sensibility. A director should have an authority, original ideas, managerial capabilities, an understanding of psychology, and general knowledge. These criteria did not match women's nature in general, especially with regards to leadership. A director should be able to rule artists, crews, and other film workers. Authority and leadership are qualities that women do not often possess. So it is very hard to imagine how this sexist analysis could pass in contemporary film scene without being attacked by feminists. But this commentary encapsulates what an ideal film director in the New Order period should be. A director should combine artistic sensibility and intellectual capacity as embodied in the figures of the intellectual artists, all these main artists that I talked about. He should also possess superior authority and leadership with qualities that strikingly resemble those of the bapa or the father in political culture. So I'm going to end this with my quote-unquote conclusion. So the reason why I wrote this chapter was mainly I would like to show more complexities of the period, because a lot of writings, I think, have dismissed the works of the New Order filmmakers as, you know, being totally complicit to state ideology, whereas all these artists showed resistance, although in subtle ways, in their films. They have different views of modernity, modernization, developmentalism, that are views that are different from the government. And then the faces of paternalism were also different. State paternalism and paternalism in film culture, they operated in different ways, but both, maybe you could say both were complementary in largely ignoring women's perspectives and limiting women's participation or involvement as decision makers in the New Order film culture. Thank you very much.
I think in time we'd be willing to take some questions on what she went over today. If no one's bold enough, then I'll ask one to start it off. When I was talking about a film with Nia Donata, when she was here, her film Erbadi Swami won the Best Film Award at the Hawaii International Film Festival. I think that was 2008. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong about that. And the film of contemporary issues related to polygamy, mm-hmm, in Indonesia. She told me that her film was really largely only received and screened in Jakarta and Surabaya. And after that, it never left really that sort of urban world. Do you think that's because she's a woman director and that people knew that, or that the theme itself didn't resonate outside the urban experience?
Yeah, I think when you talk about reformasi or political reform, you need to question what has changed and what not. And I think this is one of the issues that is still difficult to change. And her films are more accepted in the urban areas because it's like speaking to the converts, speaking to the quote unquote, I don't like to use the term liberal, but yeah, liberal subjects who are more open to these values, whereas it's a highly, polygamy is still a difficult issue in other areas in Indonesia, especially with regards to religion, because you are, people always, like the religious authorities always use the Quran as the basis for these male dominated practices. So I think in terms of culture, although we have more women filmmakers exposing women's issues, exposure towards gender issues is very much happening in certain areas. I think that's why Nia, I think in her later project, she deals with women's experiences outside the urban centers, and with more populist style. So So her style is, she uses melodrama a lot. I'm talking about her film, Perempuan Punya Cerita or Tenth of Lotus, which I was saying, oh, this is too melodramatic, and we showed the film actually at NYU, and NYU students were like, too much crying in this film, but probably Nina and others wanted to speak in a language that were close to the whatever the imagined marginal audience is. A story about women in the everyday life, story about all this crying and how crying could be empowering. And of course there's the whole problematic area of whether melodrama is related to a certain class, but yeah. Other questions?
Okay, that the KFT is
gone now. KFT still exists, but it's what do you call it? But because now we have the whole new generation of filmmakers, they just don't care that all these old institutions exist.
So they don't have to pass it by anybody.
No. No, so people, everybody, so the spirit today is like everybody can make films, and people could make, like even high school students could make film, and actually filmmakers today, they have, they organized a workshop to teach high school students or university students to make film, so there's more like a democratic way of pedagogy compared to the previous period where you have to do an apprenticeship with the director to be a filmmaker.
Oh, what's the year period that you would qualify a New World Order film?
The New Order on 1965 to 1998.
Okay. Would you say like that period also can break down into other genres? For example, like maybe 60s through the 70s would be Cold War related films. Mm-hmm. Maybe you said part of the filmmakers want to be educated in the U.S., some of the other ones in the Soviet Union. And maybe, because when I hear New World Order, I think of like late 80s, early 90s neoliberalism. Like in some of the developing film countries and things like that. And then with regard to for example, like in Thai film and in writing about it, you have people talking about like new waves, mm-hmm. or you know, things like that. And the figure of the woman also often comes about through like birth, childbirth, mm-hmm. Giving birth to something else. So like the New World Order, like a society pregnant with some kind of future change, whether it's like, you know, like skyscrapers or something like that, or whatever, mm-hmm. it's figured somehow in the narrative through, you know, being going through something, mm-hmm. like pregnant with some kind of thing. Anyways, kind of weird thing, but I think about the way in which people look at film. Sometimes they qualify only certain kind of things within that period because it belongs to a genre. So if people look at art films, for example, mostly when they talk about new wave films. Mm-hmm. But they don't talk about melodramas, which to me is a problem in aesthetics, you know, because only certain like artistic, you know, subversive kind of things, which, you know, often has the central male masculine Che Guevara looking figure or something like that, versus, you know, some melodramatic, you know, for example, teenage characters or something like that. But both can be equally political. Mm-hmm. Right, but like you said, some people would just say, oh, you know, if it's a melodrama, you know, and it shows, you know, too much gloss, it's probably complicit with state ideology or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, I think it's true about the period. So this idea of national cinema was very strong, as a discourse was very strong during the 1970s and the beginning of 1980s, and then of course we have this the new neoliberal world order, and Indonesian cinema was affected by that too. So these artists, of course, they kept talking about representing Indonesian reality, but politically, for instance, in the, what's that, 1990, American exporters, importers boycott. Yeah, so in the 1992, and of course this is related to the whole new liberal global order. So in the 1992, the Import Association of America, what was that, MPAA, Motion Pictures Association of America, they wanted to distribute Hollywood films directly to Indonesia, and if they couldn't do it, they would ban the textile export to the U.S. And so they didn't distribute it. Finally, they didn't distribute it directly, but they have to go through this one, what do you call it, monopoly-like organization. So the result is that what we could see in the big screen and in major theaters were Hollywood films, and then people started to make bad quality films, and so it changed the landscape of the period, where in the 90s you saw mostly all of these sex and violence films again.
European influence, like French film, Italian film, did Indonesian filmmakers study those or try to emulate them?
You mean during this period or no?
Yeah, I guess today too.
Today I
rely totally on, you know, learning film in America or the Soviet Union sort of.
Yeah, today I think people are more privileged with media technology and, of course, pirated DVDs. So, and also international film festivals in Indonesia and abroad. So there's more exposure to not only U.S. or European films, but also films from East Asia or Southeast Asia. According to my research, based on this period, people were inspired mostly by Italian neorealism, and also they were inspired by Indian neorealism, but more on the question of how you present national identity through realism. And India could actually produce very what they call nationalist films of Ritwik and then some other Indian neorealist directors.
You mentioned for therapists, but you have not explained about Ratna Asmara. Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Yeah, Ratna Asmara, she was actually an actress, and she directed and produced her own film, not too many in the 1930s, but the problem is there was no archive of her film, so I couldn't access it. So just like other films in the 1920s, all these films made by Shanghai producers, they were gone, so we could not see the film.
Sort of been just recently that American actresses started to do their own, you know, directing and filmmaking. I mean, we haven't been privy to that really until recent years. But now a lot of them want to do it because they think they can do a better job than what they've experienced in their careers.
You just mentioned the value of having access to archives, and I would think that I've heard that the Cinematheque, with its sort of a difficult situation financially, the National Archives in Jakarta, was frustrating to work with, to the point where people like Mira Lesman and Riri Riza and those guys
wanted to establish their own newer archive. And do you know anything about that? And where in this world do you think there would be a place for probably less available films by women?
Sorry, what was the last question?
Yeah, when we take a look at how difficult it is to find the earlier films that had any direction or participation by women, when you have an opportunity now to preserve the newer films that are being produced by even younger females in high school and things like this as they begin their careers, is there a mechanism for preserving this kind of material for future scholars and researchers? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's happening in Indonesia right now.
Yeah, that's a tough question. Well, I think in post-98, you have, there's a sense of absence of the state, and people actually did their own thing independently. So if we talk about archives, actually a lot of people did archiving. A lot of film communities, they tried to archive all these films made by community members or high school students. But there is also a constant desire for state support, so they actually try to save the cinematic. I'm not really quite familiar with the situation right now. Maybe some of the film scholars here could explain.
Yeah, I think it's too complicated. So that I can make a dissertation on that. Because there's so-called mafia hidden, and then corruption thing, and then lack of no support, no financial support from the government. And then the important thing is we should keep the films in a certain degree of, so they don't have much money for that. But it's becoming much better, I think.
And then if these filmmakers, Miral Usmana, want to donate their money to the Cinematek, they have to go through this mafia.
Yeah, that's the previous director said that if you want to donate to us, don't donate us with fresh money, because they will give me the money, the yayasan, the foundation. And then they just cut, for example, 10%. So give us the materials, like the chemical things or something.
Like one national archive, one large
national.
Yeah.
Right. Actually, it was founded by Misbah Shadiran as the first cinematic in Southeast in Asia in 1975, and for some good reason, Misbah founded the foundation, and the foundation soon. Support what the KFP and the other organizations, they have an office in the same building with Cinematek. So it's not owned by government, it's owned by it's not private too, but I don't know. But the Jakarta government, they just this is our building, go ahead, use the building, and then internet, KFP there, the office of KFP is there, and then the other film organizations, the other organizations there, and then but later, in the last 2 years, the library, National Library, they support the Cinematek, and they have the problem of the digitalization. And then it's interesting because the museum of Singapore, National Museum of Singapore, they support financially, they choose classical films, Sidadara or the prison to be restored in Amsterdam Film Museum, and then I think in Canberra. But the thing is, like in 2008, there was a conference on audiovisual archive in Bandung, organized by Siapapa, and then they invited many of archivists in the whole West Java, and then one of the participants just asked them, and, oh, I just know that there is a cinematic in Indonesia. So it's lack of information. It's only few people go to the cinematic, and it's irony because they have like very good library.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, there are always attempts to save cinematic or to save to restore certain films from here and there, but it's not like a systematic.
It's just like
attempt.
Let's say cinematic is not like well organized.
Yeah.
Like the Bulan Film National
Film
Month, they have like the program for the whole man, and one of the program is like to save the cinematic. They sold the t-shirts like with very cool old school poster films, and then all of most of the donation goes to the cinematic, and then they are like a fundraising, like they this is very interesting because not many people go to cinematic and rent the film, you know. And the program rent many films, and that's very rare thing because it's very hard to access those kind of film in Indonesia. So we should wait for certain for particular festival or for the format. That's gonna be every month we have a national film program.
Good, thank you. Any final comments or questions? Well, as she enters her dissertation writing phase, we wish you well, and we hope that we get to read this dissertation when it's published.
Next week, right?
Yeah, I'm waiting
for your feedback.
Thank you very much.
Mahalo for listening to the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series podcast. If you'd like to download, comment on, or share this podcast, as well as subscribe to our weekly announcement listserv, please visit us at cseashawaii.com.